There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Frank Gill, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Frank, whose voice my 12-year-old son last night heard and described as sick. Catherine, that's a compliment, I'm assuming.
Yeah, nothing to add. If your son thinks it's sick, then I bow to his better judgment about what's sick and what's not.
Yes, indeed. Well, I actually did think it was very good, if that is exactly what my son was referring to. So thank you very much, Frank, for your cool in my vernacular and sick in my son's vernacular voice for introducing this edition of the show. And thank you for being a friend of the Tennis Podcast. If you are listening to this and thinking, oh, I wouldn't mind having an intro at the start of a show and potentially being called sick, then you can by becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast. You can also get a shout out. You can also... If you are quick, you've only got a few days left to do this. You could guest edit a show. You could take us on in predictions. We even have one executive producer slot left, but there are not many left, folks. So if you want to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast at one of those levels, get in there quickly. Catherine, how were the Quokkas?
Oh, where to begin, David? They did not disappoint. It was a magical day, absolutely magical.
Yeah, Catherine has been in Perth for a while, done United Cup, and then yesterday did the Quokkas. And Matt, what did we wake up to yesterday on the Tennis Podcast WhatsApp group?
Just an avalanche of photos, fantastic photos that we had to judge and decide which was the best one. I mean, I'm still getting my head around the fact that Catherine booked the early ferry to go and see the Quokkas. It was either a 7 a.m. or
Matt,
a 10 a.m.
The earliest ferry.
Mm, yeah.
First one of the day.
Earliest. Incredible. I mean, who is this person we're going to meet in Australia?
And honestly, you saw about 20% of the total Quokka photos that are on my phone. I thought I was incredibly restrained with my spam, quite frankly.
Yeah, ration yourself, Catherine. We've got 3 weeks to look at them.
I would also just like to say, as an accompanying bit of knowledge to all the Quokka photos that lots of people might have seen on our social media, the lengths that I went to get those photos, when you're judging my Quokka selfie against Roger Federer's, just please bear in mind that I could be wrong about this, but I don't think Roger Federer physically crawled on his hands and knees inside a tree in the Aussie bush, which is what I did. I have cuts all over my legs.
There was no mud on his knee.
No, I woke up this morning absolutely done in. I cycled 30 kilometres yesterday in search of Quokkas, stopping at the occasional beach, But mostly prioritizing the quokkas. Lengths were gone too, and not in vain.
I'm not sensing a great deal of sympathy from our listeners right now. your 30-kilometer ride of a bike in the sunshine looking for quokkas. But I take your point. You did go to extreme lengths, and Matt's eagle-eyed observation of mud on the knees in the photos was really quite something, and it does tell its own story. So listen, we've got loads of tennis to talk about, and in terms of getting up early, nobody's gone to greater lengths than Matt this morning, because he has been up basically all night watching the extraordinary numbers of tennis matches going on back to back, and some of them at the same time. So we've got loads and loads to catch up on. Before we do that, let's just remind you of the fact that this edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. I can't do it in sync yet, Catherine. I have to be in your company to pull that off.
Okay.
So I will work on it. And also, thank goodness you'll be presenting by the time I get to Melbourne. On Location will be the official hospitality provider of the Olympic and Paralympic Games Paris 2024. That means that you can gain unparalleled access to the Olympic Games when they take place in Paris from Friday the 26th of July to Sunday the 11th of August 2024. So this year, it's only 7 or 8 months away, and you could be in Paris at the Olympic Games. On Location offers you the chance to be a part of history with tailor-made offerings that include guaranteed tickets and a wide range of options to make your time at Paris 2024 truly epic. There are phenomenal packages available for all sports, from swimming to gymnastics, fencing to boxing, but also private boxes at none other than Roland Garros to watch your favourite tennis players go for gold. A special section is now featured at the top of the Tennis Podcast sponsor page on the On Location website that will direct you to their official Olympic Games travel and hospitality packages. You just need to go to tours4tennis.com/podcast. That's tours4tennis.com/podcast. Packages can be purchased online, or a dedicated On Location team member can contact you directly to create your perfect package. And of course, the link is in our show notes and also in our newsletter. If you're not subscribed to that yet, get on it. Matt Stat is back. Predictions are back. I've already got one wrong, and that's because Rafael Nadal didn't win Brisbane. Catherine, maybe I should have known better.
Well, I've got one wrong as well, because Poland didn't win the United Cup. And what I was going to say as an addendum to the On Location blurb, re the Olympics and the incredible experience that you could have at the Olympics courtesy of On Location, is TBC on whether you'll have the chance to see Iga Świątek and Hubert Hurkacz in mixed doubles, I would say.
Aha, because we've just witnessed the Poland against Germany final, which Iga Świątek started perfectly by winning the opening rubber against Angelique Kerber. Then Hubert Hurkacz had 2 match points against Alexander Zverev. He wasn't able to take them. There was one, frankly, incredible passing shot on the run from Zverev that caught the outside edge of the line to save the match. And then I'm afraid, from a Hubert Hurkacz perspective, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say he kind of reverted to type and just disappeared for the rest of the match. He was not a factor in the rest of that match. And then by the time they got to the mixed doubles, really, Germany were always the better team. They got into the decider, did Poland, but I don't know. What did you two think? I always felt like Germany were going to end up winning that tie. What did you think, Matt?
Certainly, once it got to the mixed doubles and that match started, it did feel like Germany had the momentum and also the upper hand on that doubles court. I mean, Laura Siegmund is a very, very savvy doubles player, isn't she? She really positions herself well on the court and comes up with some great shots at the right time and sort of gets in opponents' heads. We know all about that as well. So, you know, Zverev and her made a very, very good combination. But it just shouldn't have been allowed to go to the doubles. I mean, Hubert Hurkacz, I'm sorry, but Alexander Zverev got to bed at 5:45 a.m. that morning. And he was totally there for the taking. And Hubert Hurkacz showed why we don't pick him to go far in slams, why he doesn't go far in slams, why he does have not a great record against sort of players ranked high in the world. You know, he's got such a good game. He's got such an amazing serve. And his backhand is kind of on the money all the time. He can come forward. You know, there's so much good about his game. And yet, in those biggest moments, you don't trust him. And okay, Zverev came up with that amazing passing shot on the first match point. Incredible shot. But then Hurkacz made three unforced errors and gave away the tiebreak. And then his energy in the third set was really, really poor, you know, compared to Zverev, who was knackered, clearly. You know, that was the element where Hurkacz had such a huge advantage. He sort of lost it a bit mentally as well. He was lucky not to get disqualified at one point, the way he threw his racket and almost hit the ball kid at the back of the court. It was just all over the place from Hurkacz. You know, I know he was trying his best, but it did just feel like he was sort of doing everything he possibly could so that Poland didn't win this title. And, you know, and then that sort of carried over into the mixed doubles as well, where, you know, he was going after Świątek's shots and leaving the court a bit open and just not positioning himself well. You know, just a really tough day for Hubert Hurkacz, but one that isn't that much of a surprise, really. Like, it is kind of in keeping with what we've seen from him in the past in really tight, big moments. His game can fold in on itself a little bit, and that's not a good trait to have. And it's so contrary to Iga Świątek, you know, who raises her game in big moments. Seeing that contrast was just kind of extraordinary to witness. But yeah, an unbelievable comeback from Germany, who were on the ropes in the semifinals as well. So to win it in such dramatic fashion in both the semifinals and the final, late at night both times, hell of a team effort from Kerber, Siegmund and Zverev.
Yeah, it will be interesting. I mean, I think Kerber, I don't view as a factor at the Australian Open, other than it's great to see her back. I just feel like it's too big a stretch to imagine that she could contend for the title. And she did take pretty lopsided defeats to Sakkari and to Świątek, although she had a good win against Tomljanovic in a really epic match. Just packed house, very, very great, a good contest. I think it will be interesting what Zverev does at the Australian Open, because I think he's rarely come in to the events. I think he has had great end of seasons, but this is the first time he's come out at the start of the season and really looked like he's elevated. And I wonder whether this has taken maybe a bit out of him, but then he does have a week to prepare for the event. But he was frankly incredible the last couple of days, and yeah, we'll watch to see what he ends up going on to do. He did, though, take a defeat the day before, Catherine, to Alex de Minaur. And talking about people elevating their levels, I would say he has elevated his level to probably a point that I didn't think he'd got in him, based on the results that he's had this week. I know it's not quite the same as an Australian Open, but what has he beaten? He's beaten Taylor Fritz. He's beaten Novak Djokovic, who, well, I didn't see the match. I know he was feeling his wrist, and I don't believe that is the same Novak Djokovic as we'll be getting in a week's time, but it's still significant that he actually beat him in a competitive match. And then he's fought back to beat a guy who'd got a 6-1 record against him in Zverev. What did you make of what you saw from de Minaur?
Yeah, well, just taking the Zverev match to start with, I think that's a heck of a win for Alex de Minaur. Personally, I think as impressive as the win over Djokovic, because all respect to de Minaur for that win over Djokovic. A win over Djokovic is always a win over Djokovic. I do think it will have a pretty heavy asterisk next to it in terms of Djokovic's fitness and his willingness to go to the Djokovician dark places to win. I think he would have preferred to win of course, he's Novak Djokovic. But there is a difference between Djokovic that is willing to put his body on the line for victory at all costs. And that wasn't the Djokovic that Dumoulin was playing. Zverev, though, as you say, David, this is Zverev in peak Zverev form, utterly grooved, utterly in that groove, you know, played himself into possibly the best tennis I've ever seen him play. And Dumoulin, however well he's playing, has this 6-1 head-to-head against him that does not lie. That matchup is, well, up until last night, was horrible for Alex Dumoulin, and it looked pretty horrible throughout that opening set, I thought. It was very gritty from Dumoulin, but it felt like he was hanging in all the way through that opening set, and then the inevitable dam bursting and Zverev winning it in the end, and it all felt like it was proceeding to script, really. And I'm so impressed with the grit that Alex Dumoulin showed, and not just the grit, but the game to back up that grit. His movement and his speed has always been gasp-inducing. But to see an element of explosivity in his game sort of added to that, it has made him actually, in moments, quite spectacular. And I don't think I've ever, ever said the word spectacular and Alex Dumoulin in the same sentence. Sorry, like, I've always had a lot of respect for him and liked him as a person and all the rest of it. But spectacular, explosive, these have not been the words that I've associated. But look, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'm not a slave to them. But from the eye test, and I've watched him in person over the course of the last week, he has beefed up every single shot. There must be more kilometers per hour on, absolutely on the serve and on the ground strokes as well. I mean, he physically looks bigger to me on the court. He looks. Taller in stature. You can see he's always going to be a certain body type. He hasn't suddenly turned into the Hulk, but he just looks more solid and he has more presence. He just feels like a different tennis player to me. I still think there's a ceiling. He's not suddenly Carlos Alcaraz, but I thought there was a ceiling prior to what I've seen this week, and he's pushed that ceiling upwards. So who's to say that he can't again? I'm so impressed with him. I think the draw is going to be crucial and very interesting from an Alex Dumoulin perspective, but he's a top 10 player, and that's kind of snuck up on me a bit, Alex Dumoulin making it into the top 10, but he deserves to be.
Yeah, first Australian to reach the top 10, first male Australian to reach the top 10 since Hewitt in 2006. Like, that's a big deal for Alex Dumoulin to get there. And look, I think he had that win last year at the United Cup, didn't he, against Rafael Nadal? And that was a little bit similar to his one over Novak Djokovic this year, I suppose. Like, it was a slightly compromised version of that all-time great. But I think he backed it up brilliantly with that win over Zverev here. And it does show an elevation, and the one against Fritz as well. You know, that's three top 10 wins in a row. That's really, really impressive. And I thought his serve against Djokovic was so good. I mean, as we said, Djokovic was struggling. He was out of sorts. He was feeling his wrist. But even so, I would have felt like maybe Dumoulin previously would have been one of those players that Djokovic would be able to beat, even not at his sharpest. But Dumoulin just didn't allow that. He only lost one point on serve behind his first serve against Novak Djokovic. I mean, that's the sort of thing that John Isner or Riley Opelka or Ivo Karlovic might possibly do, but probably still not. And that, even that was
that
when he
was
serving
right
for
at the
it.
End of the match,
yeah,
wasn't it? He was so close to the clean slate.
I had to change my tweet that was ready about 100% first serve points won, but you know, and also He was using a sliced backhand. That was something that Jim Courier was very impressed with in commentary. And I've seen him do that a little bit against Medvedev. He's had a couple of wins over Medvedev, and that slice has been a good shot. And yeah, just these little incremental improvements in his game to create an overall package that is much improved on where he was a few years ago. And I do think he gets a boost playing for Australia. You know, he is one of the players who is a better version of himself when he puts on the green and gold, as he would say. And he particularly loves the Ken Rosewall Arena in Sydney, doesn't he? He describes that as his favourite court in the world. So, you know, being able to replicate that outside of this event is another challenge for him, but I think he can, and I hope he can, because he's, as you said, he's a really fun presence to have around when you combine just this potential to win big matches with the speed and explosivity that he has in his game. He's a really good watch. So yeah, fair play, Alex de Minaur.
He's got he's the spirit of a sensation, isn't he? But in the body of a top 10 player.
he certainly gets the hype of 10 sensations when he's over in Australia. And I mean, look, if he plays Djokovic again, you watch, they will be referring back to this win he's had as if this is the moment that we should all be remembering, rather than the absolute drumming he took at the hands of Djokovic a year ago. I'm afraid to say I still think he would probably lose fairly handily if they played each other in Melbourne, but I think he'd make it closer, certainly. So we'll see what happens. In terms of Djokovic generally, while I didn't watch the match, I did watch the interview you did with Goran Ivanišević courtside, Catherine, in which he very clearly made it clear that this was not a serious injury in his mind, and Novak Djokovic had got three matches in, were his words. You know, he got a few matches in, and I think that he's exactly generally where he'll probably need to be. Obviously, we don't know whether an injury might be more serious than we see, but just based on history and the vibes I got from that, I think Djokovic will be just fine by the time Melbourne comes around. Just as a final point on the United Cup, we did touch on it a week ago, and I feel even more strongly now, this was a major move on from a year ago in terms of the format they used, in terms of the kind of acceptance of the public and the buy-in, really. The atmosphere the last few days, and I would expect a good atmosphere when Australia play, but it was immense. And even today, Poland against Germany, which is a test for an event, a big final like that in Australia, I would say, it was packed and it was a great atmosphere, and it was just so cool that so many matches came down to the mixed doubles decider, Catherine. I just feel like that event 2 years in has already shown that it has got the goods.
Yeah, absolutely. It felt very apt, didn't it, that the final came down to the mixed doubles, and indeed to a match tiebreak in the mixed doubles, because it did feel to me that so many of the matches had been decided that way. And for me, that's exactly what you want from this kind of event. That's its USP, and you want that front and centre as much as possible. And I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed seeing these players in different types of environment, both sort of tennis wise and atmosphere wise. Iga Świątek, for example, I don't think she's a natural team environment person, just like Novak Djokovic, really. I think she's an incredibly tunnel visioned, fastidious, leave no stone unturned in the pursuit of my own personal goals type person. And I still, you know, I don't think she's had a personality transplant over the course of the last 10 days, and yet I saw her sort of find a way to make that fit within a team environment. And actually, she had a really cool vibe, I thought, up until about 25 minutes ago with Hubert Hurkacz. Not sure what the vibe will be like right at this moment. She was absolutely gutted, wasn't she, in defeat, in tears on the sidelines. And I know I always sound so awful when people cry, because I'm like, I love to see that. But I do love to see that. I love to see, provided that she's, you know, overall okay, I love to see the the indicators of how much they care, especially in this event, which is finding its feet and its place in the tennis world. I think things like that kind of matter in terms of its validation in the tennis world. I still think there's some tweaks that could be made. I don't love the whole best runner-up qualifying for the quarterfinals thing. I think that is a bit muddy and complicated. I'm not sure tennis has ever figured out the best way to do round robin, and I certainly haven't figured it out either, but I do know that it's not three teams / players in a group. I don't think, and this applies to Billie Jean King Cup, this applies across the board, I don't think three teams in a group really works. I know why they've tried to do it. I know why they have to have lots of teams. I know why there have to be six groups of three. They have to provide, you know, it's essentially a tour event. They have to provide playing opportunities to as many countries as possible. It can't just be for the elite nations, etc., etc. As always, I'm quite sure there are factors at play that I either don't know about or haven't considered, and I know it's incredibly difficult. But for me, I would find a way to change that, because I just think it's proven not to really be the best way forward as a format. But I like that this event hasn't been too proud to make really significant changes, and I kind of trust them to continue tweaking it for the better on the basis of the progression over the past couple of years.
Yeah, well, I just hope ultimately that it is allowed to have a future, because there's so much talk currently about a Saudi Arabia event coming in to disturb that situation.
One last point, and this is, as everyone will know, not unique or specific to the United Cup, but matches in general shouldn't be finishing at 1 a.m. and certainly not your two, the culminating moments of your two biggest ties shouldn't be taking place at 1 a.m. local time after the last train has literally left the station. Stop doing this, tennis. Stop it.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because Alex de Minaur had just won this incredible match over Alexander Zverev in the semi-final, and that followed the Kerber Tomjanovic epic, and it was set up for this dramatic, brilliant mixed doubles, which was dramatic and brilliant. 15-13, I think, in the match tiebreak. And Alex de Minaur had pleaded for the crowd to get noisy and get rowdy, and, you know, that was I was so pumped for it. But then you realise, actually, it's the early hours in Sydney and people have got to get home, and the train's left. And by the end of that mixed doubles in the semi-final, I mean, the stadium was virtually empty, understandably. I mean, those that were there were still making a good noise, but it was a shame. And tennis does keep doing this, and it's so frustrating, because everything else about the event, you know, I completely agree about the group stage format with three in the round robin, but sort of everything else, the emphasis on the mixed doubles, the look of it on TV, all the social media that was produced by the tournament was all really, really good. What you want for an event. And it's much improved on last year, this slightly streamlined version. And yeah, I hope it's got a future, because it really adds to the first week of the season. I think the ATP Cup took away, you know, it sort of kiboshed the other events, and there was just too much faff, and there was also sort of, what's the point of this? We've just had the Davis Cup. But the United Cup really does add, I think, to the first week of the season, and I hope they're allowed to just keep improving it. And as you said, I trust that they will if they get that chance.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. And it's great to see Brisbane back, as you referenced last week, Matt, as part of the new setup. And overnight, we had the two biggest names in that draw facing off in Elena Rybakina and Aryna Sabalenka. But I did not expect to wake up to a scoreline of 6-love, 6-3 for Rybakina. You were up. You were up at 4:30 to watch that. Tell us what happened.
So much overwhelming tennis stuff happened this morning, and it was not even 9:30 a.m. I mean, so much to get your head round, and this was one of the biggest things to get your head round, because I guess I've just come to expect Rybakina-Sabalenka matches to be really, really great and high quality and close, because so many of their matches have been. Of course, we all remember last year's Australian Open final, which was just one of the all-time great Grand Slam finals. But I suppose it was this scoreline, the kind of thing that can happen when you get two massive hitters coming up against each other. And I think it's been extraordinary that their matches have been so good up until this point. Because it doesn't take much for just one player to be a little bit off and one player to be at the absolute peak of their powers, as was the case here. Sabalenka was pretty error-strewn and Rybakina was unbelievably good. And then you get this huge disparity in the scoreline. Mostly what I remember is how good Rybakina was. I mean, it took an hour for Sabalenka to hold serve. The difference in demeanour was just kind of extraordinary. Rybakina so calm, so poised. Sabalenka a little bit like the Sabalenka we sometimes see in these really big matches. You know, she can get a little flustered, a little in her own head. But I thought Rybakina was stunning. And if anyone needed the off-season, I think it was her, wasn't it? You know, her first half of 2023 was much better than her second half when she got ill and injured halfway through the season. And it always felt like she was trying to catch up to the level that she'd shown at the start of the year, but never quite able to do it with the just relentlessness of the schedule. But she's had a break and she's come out and she's just playing the most brilliant tennis. Only dropped 15 games in five matches. So it wasn't just a one-off in this final. You know, she was absolutely on it the entire week. Really, really impressed. Her serve was back. You know, we talked a lot last year about how her serve tailed off through the second half of the season. High percentage today, a lot of cheap points. Yeah, just impossible to be anything other than impressed. And anyone who can take the racket out of Aryna Sabalenka's hand, like, that's a remarkable feat, because Sabalenka normally when she loses, I still feel like Sabalenka's in control of the match. You know, I think of her losses at the Slams last season, Mukova, Jabeur, Goff, they were all able to disrupt Sabalenka and throw her off her rhythm. But ultimately, the matches felt on Sabalenka's racket. And this one just did not at all today because of how brilliant Rybakina was with her own power game. Yeah, just an incredible performance. And I think it puts her right up there as a favourite at the Australian Open. You know, I think she's... I'd probably put her and Świątek side by side as the favourites right now.
And that's so fascinating, isn't it? Because of their head-to-head and the difficulties that even peak Świątek has had against Rybakina in the past. I mean, I feel like going into every slam, there's kind of one match that I insist that the draw and the tournament gives us. And on the women's side, for me, it is Świątek Rybakina. I'm desperate for it because Świątek has made technical adjustments to her game this off-season, specifically geared at dealing with Rybakina and Sabalenka, but in particular Rybakina, I think, because she's had a bit of a matchup problem. Rybakina seems to have been able to take time away from her consistently in their meetings better than anybody can. She looks rushed, or she has in the past looked rushed against Rybakina, and she's been trying to shorten those swings, hasn't she, and get more out of her serve to try and kind of match Rybakina for cheap points. I mean, I'm not sure anybody can match Rybakina just at the moment at her peak, but I so desperately want to see that match, and I've no idea who I would pick to win it. I've seen so much of Świątek in the past week, and I've been so seduced by her game. She just looks so bang on it. I can't believe how well those changes have bedded in, as I said on the previous podcast. But equally, I know it's different against Rybakina, and matchups are everything in this sport. And this looks to be absolute peak Rybakina again. And it really does emphasise the fact that I don't think she was physically... I don't think she's been physically right since the start of the clay court season. I really don't think that second half of last year was the real Rybakina. And I think on the basis of this week, the real Rybakina is back, and that's exciting.
Yeah, that was occurring to me as you were talking us through that match, that we've finally got what you've been asking for, Catherine, a fresh human being again, somebody who's not just jaded by the rigors of the tour. It's so relentless. So yeah, Rybakina goes in tip-top form, as does Świątek. It will be fascinating. We also had in Brisbane victory for a very different kind of player in Grigor Dimitrov, who overcame Holger Rune 7-6, 6-4 in the final. First title since 2017, more than 6 years ago. And I felt pretty moved by what I saw from Grigor Dimitrov, who anybody who's listened to this over the last nearly 12 years of podcasting, Catherine, will know that he's always been kind of our guy, hasn't he? And we've always hoped that, I guess, he would have done a lot more with his career than he has. Certainly, I thought he would do a lot more than he has. And yet it's only now, in his early 30s, I said this a few times last year, and I feel it even more now, that he understands his own game today better than he ever has. And frankly, if he could have come to this realization and this focus and kind of just self-belief as to what he's doing and clarity, he would have been somebody achieving a lot more over the years. And yet maybe there's still something ahead. What do you think, Catherine? That's a hell of a win today.
He's looking dangerous, isn't he?
You never know.
Look, I think, yeah, I don't want to take anything away from the man himself, but this is a heck of a coaching job from Jaime Delgado. Think of how many people Grigor Dimitrov has worked with over the years. And no, this isn't his first title. It's not even his biggest title. And I know general age and maturity will be playing a part in what you just described, David, him sort of coming to realizations about his game. But age and maturity come with downsides as well. They come with an awful lot of baggage. So for Jamie Delgado to be getting this out of him, this that others have tried to unlock and tried valiantly to unlock and yet still failed, I find tremendously impressive, actually. I find it tremendously impressive that he's managed to carry over form, indoor form from the end of season into outdoor form at the start of the next season. That's bloody difficult to do, especially with a player like Grigor, who you just feel like it, instinctively, because of that baggage you just described, because we carry that baggage as well from watching him, it just instinctively feels frail, doesn't it? You feel like, oh God, don't, nobody move. It could all fall apart. I'm not going to answer your question about what it means and what he's going to do in Melbourne. I don't know. Matt, come on, what do you think?
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because I would say he's playing like the smartest tennis of his career. As you said, like he understands his game better than he ever has. And crucially, he's managed to do that at a time where he's still incredibly good physically. He's still able to defend when he has to. And sort of seeing him go toe-to-toe today in those rallies with Holger Rune, you know, who is, you know, an incredible athlete as well, shows that he hasn't lost a lot there. So there is still time. I think it's not like he's suddenly figured out his game, but he's physically declined and he can't make the most of it. But of course, the big question is that baggage that he has built up, and whether he's, you know, whether his nerve lasts in big matches when he, you know, if he has Jannik Sinner in the quarterfinals, for example. Like tennis-wise, I think Grigor can maybe win that match. You know, obviously Sinner's tennis is phenomenally good as well, but Dimitrov's got ways to hurt him. But do we trust him mentally? And I don't think we can answer that question until we see it. But it's amazing that he's making these strides at this stage in his career. There was a slight slightly amusing moment at the end of the match when he had won it and he held out his five fingers, which everyone was interpreting as that's how long it's been since his last title. And I was like, well, I hope it wasn't that, because it's actually been 6 years. Like, so maybe the five fingers was something else. But generally, it's a really good time to be Grigor Dimitrov. And I loved the way that going into that final with Holger Rune, the interviewer said to him, oh, you're up against a great all-court player. And he said, yeah, but I'm a great all-court player as well. You know, there's a confidence to him. And I loved hearing that. And what a special moment for him to finally win another title. And he did have a good year last year. He didn't take many bad losses at all. He just wasn't finishing tournaments off. And once he put himself in a good position, he might crack. But already he's shown an improvement in 2024 again. So really, really impressive. And I can't sort of do this section of the podcast while we're getting our hopes up without just mentioning the fact that the only player to take a set off him in Brisbane was one Andy Murray. So maybe there are good signs for Andy Murray as well.
I'm just looking up Dimitrov's live ranking, by the way, 14. So that'll, unless there are pullouts, that'll be his seeding at the Australian Open. So he's going to be a fourth round opponent for one of the very top guys. And none of them are going to want him. Djokovic will want him.
And Zverev will want to, because he always beats him. I mean, there's just certain people that are a real problem for Dimitrov over the best of five, I think. And there's certain people he can cause real problems to. So the draw really will be important, I think, for him. And I think that that's true of a few of these guys. I think, and on both sides, on the women's draw too, I think it's a really interesting draw. One of the most interesting that I can remember for a while.
He's beaten Alcaraz, hasn't he?
Mm.
Beat Alcaraz at the end of last year.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's fascinating, and I think there's a lot of depth to the draws and a lot of intrigue. I can't wait for it all. One person who isn't part of that intrigue, I'm sorry to say, is Rafael Nadal. And I think if you went back a few days and you were in the Tennis Podcast WhatsApp group, you'd have been very much thinking that Rafael Nadal would be part of the intrigue, because we went from thinking, what chance has this guy got, to thinking anything's possible.
It's a good because job we didn't record a podcast wins on Thursday, because I think we'd have to delete it now.
I posted a photo of him with the Roland Garros trophy.
On publicly?
No, in our WhatsApp group.
Oh, well, yes, you did. You did.
Dominic Thiem, first of all, got beaten, and then he defeated Jason Kubler, and he just looked so ravenous for the sport. He looked like he had been caged and was let out, and he was just going to run amok all over everybody.
That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking back on it is Matt posted a picture of him with the Roland Garros trophy after a victory over Jason Kubler.
Yes, but you know, we were getting excited.
It's possible, guys, we were getting a bit ahead of ourselves. Who can say?
And then while we were recording our Tennis Relived edition, looking back at the 2008 Australian Open, he also happened to be playing against Jordan Thompson at the time, which we'd all got up on the screen and were sort of concentrating on that as well. Do go and have a listen to that Tennis Relived show if you're a friend of the Tennis Podcast, or become a friend for that matter, and you'll be able to listen to that and many more other bonus podcasts aside. Really enjoyed doing that Tennis Relived on 2008, rolling back the years. But shortly after this match against Jordan Thompson and towards the end of it, you saw him having conversations with a very pensive-looking Carlos Moyer and Mark Lopez, and the dad was in the box, and he'd hurt himself. You could tell he'd pulled something. It was just a question of what. How bad was it? He gave a press conference. He said, I don't know what my future is going to be. And then this morning, about 4 seconds after Grigor Dimitrov had won the title, he posted a tweet to say that during his last match in Brisbane, he'd had a small muscular problem in a similar sort of area, a micro tear in a muscle in the similar sort of area where he had the surgery, but not actually that same thing. It doesn't sound serious, he says, but he's going to pull out the Australian Open and try to avoid being out for several months rather than just a little while. And so, yeah, no Australian Open for Rafael Nadal. Matt, can we afford, from a Nadal perspective, to be enthusiastic and optimistic based on what we've seen? Or do the fact that he's put two and a half matches in and pulled up injured make you feel this is probably not going to happen?
It does make me regret putting the photo of him with the Roland Garros trophy in the WhatsApp group. What I would say is that Nadal is being positive, isn't he? That is overall quite a positive message. And Nadal is not always that guy. He is sometimes very serious with these statements, and you know, he really lets you feel when it's bad. And I didn't quite get the sense with this one. I think it's very much a, well, there's absolutely no way I can play the Australian Open, but it doesn't mean that my comeback generally is ruined. And he's mentioned in that statement that he wants to be at his best level in 3 months. And of course, that is conveniently the time when the clay court season starts. And I get the sense now that that's the heart of his comeback, isn't it? And generally, he has not been injured on clay through his career. You know, that has been a surface which is, I mean, it's kind of on everyone's body, isn't it? But it's you know, Nadal and clay, they just go hand in hand with each other. And he's tended to be able to get through the clay court season without too many injuries. But it is a worry that he's, you know, staying fit is going to be the problem, I think, because we saw the level of tennis. If he's playing like that on any surface, but especially on clay, he's going to be beating most players, I think. But whether he can actually stay fit is the issue. But I trust Nadal's statement there, and I'm taking some positives that this is not the same injury. It's minor. It's obviously a huge blow to be out of the Australian Open. It really is, when he's gone all the way over to Australia. And he had this huge grin on his face, didn't he? You know, and he was talking about his comeback being a great news. And I just thought, we are so back. And then to have it end like that so abruptly is such a shame. But I do hold out some hope that the clay court season can still bring a lot of joy for Rafael Nadal this season. I do believe that. Nadal on clay is different. It's less bad on his body. And he's got another 3 months to build up some strength. I think we can be optimistic, but I won't be posting him with the Coupe de Mousquetaire again until he's actually holding it.
Probably best to ditch Indian Wells and Miami, Rafa, I think.
Somebody might have even written, "We are so back," in the WhatsApp group. I can't remember who.
The other interesting additions to the WhatsApp group, Catherine, were when Naomi Osaka was playing. And it's quite fun when there's a match that's at about 2 a.m. our time, and Catherine's up Perth and saying, "Osaka looks seriously good." And then, "I still say she looks good, even though Pliskova won," in the next message. But, I mean, you were generally encouraged, Catherine, weren't you? You saw that match. I didn't see it. I did see the first round match she played. We talked about that last week. But generally, you know, the chances are you're going to run into somebody who's got it together a bit more than you when you've had that long out. And she was close, and she was encouraged, and you were encouraged.
I was really encouraged. I mean, the hardest thing to get back when you're coming back, as I understand it, is the match toughness, the ability to play your best when the pressure is most on. It's something you absolutely just simply cannot replicate in practice. The only way to do it is to put yourself in those positions, which is why I think it was good for her that she ended up going three sets in her opening match. I think it'll end up being good for her that she had a tough match against Pliskova, even though she lost it. I think I don't think, you know, winning matches 2-2 is necessarily what she needs by now. I'm pretty convinced that the level is there, that she can hit that level. I thought the ball striking was great, the movement was great. I mean, if you've got those two things, if Naomi Osaka can get herself in a position to strike a tennis ball, then she's as good as anybody at it. So those are the two things I was looking for. I thought the serve looked pretty good. It was just when the pressure was on, she just drops a little bit. Either made an error or just backed off a little bit or doubted herself a little bit. I think that will come back. I don't think she's lost her nerve. I just think she needs to keep being in those situations. So I actually think that, I mean, look, the draw is going to be critical for her. She's not going to be seeded. She could face Iga Swiatek in the first round. So obviously the draw is critical. But I actually think it could be good for her to have some tough matches earlier on. Obviously tough matches that she ideally wins. But I don't think it'll be any bad thing for her to really work her way into the competition. But you can't do that if you get Iga Swiatek in the first or second round. So all eyes on the draw once again. But I think the level is there from Osaka. I was overall extremely impressed. And I just loved the way she was talking and loved. There was so much more lightness about her energy around the place. And I know that's the freshness of the start of a season and the start of a comeback, and I'm sure some of the sheen will wear off, but hopefully not all of it. I remain extremely excited, but I won't be posting photos of her with the Daphne Atkins trophy in our WhatsApp group just yet.
We're learning and growing. Down, Matt.
Yeah. You wait until you see what I'm going to post of Grigor in a week or so. Anyway, the two remaining tournaments that were happening amongst the 600 that Matt watched overnight were Auckland and Hong Kong. Coco Gauff winning Auckland, beating Elena Svitolina 6-7, 6-3, 6-3 in the final. Andre Rublev beating Emil Ruusuvuori 6-4, 6-4 in the Hong Kong final. I watched him overcome Marta Fies, obviously, about 3 days ago in a pretty tight match, and Rublev, yeah, he had his troubles in that, but he got through it, and he just kind of wins what he's supposed to win, doesn't he? What about Coco Gauff, Matt? Because I guess you could say she won what she was supposed to as well, but it's mightily impressive, isn't it, that she just comes out, no sort of drama, and just wins.
Yeah, so this is back-to-back Auckland titles for her now. She won it last year. She's defended it. She was the favourite to defend it. You know, she was by far and away the best player in that draw, and she cruised through to the final without dropping a set. But then really, really tested in this final against Svitolina. And it probably should have been 6-3, 6-3 to Coco Gauff. She was 5-3 up in that first set, serving for it, had 40-15, hit a double fault and struggled at the end of that set. And once Svitolina gets her teeth into a match, she becomes so difficult to shake off. So I think it's really impressive that that Coco Gauff managed to reset after losing that first set in a tiebreak. And then she won the next two sets, 6-3, 6-3. It was kind of like, okay, put that first set behind me. I've just got to do that again, but just finish it off. And she did that twice. There were certain occasions where Svitolina was trading forehands with her and trying to break it down and target it, and it did leak some errors. But generally, it was a good all-round complete performance from Coco Gauff. And she goes into the Australian Open, you know, for the first time as a major champion going into a Grand Slam. I always think that's an adjustment for a player, you know, that can be a great thing to have that experience. I always remember what Naomi Osaka said about actually kind of, I mean, she did just win her second slam immediately after her first, didn't she? But she said it's harder because you know how hard it is to win a slam, you know, whereas when you're going into a slam without it, you maybe play with a bit more freedom. But Coco Gauff is with a bit of a target on her back, and it's just a new experience for her. And I can't wait to see her at the Australian Open. She's perfectly tuned up for it. And this was a very impressive win, and also a very impressive week for Elena Svitolina, who has continued where she was last season. I don't think she played after the US Open, did she? But, you know, she was right back there again as the player we saw last season, a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more on her ball. Brilliant tussle with Emma Raducanu that she had. She looks physically really strong as well. So lots to enjoy from her perspective as well. Just a nice tournament, Auckland, I always think.
Yeah. And actually, as you mentioned there, some encouragement for Emma Raducanu, who has, like Naomi Osaka and Rafael Nadal, just come out of zero, really, and found a way to piece some good tennis together, seemingly okay physically, had a real tussle there with Svitolina, and now gets gets into the Australian Open without needing a wild card because one or two players have been forced to withdraw. So let's hope Raducanu can stay fit as well. Also, just a quick note from Hong Kong on the form of Jerry Shang, who is a player we've mentioned once or twice over the course of the last year, had a very good run. Just loved seeing these players have a bit of a breakout and then following their progress when they go into a Grand Slam. Can they build on it? And that's what we'll be looking to monitor over the next few weeks, because we'll be off to Australia in just a couple of days' time, Matt and I, to join Catherine in Melbourne. And yeah, we've thoroughly enjoyed, I think, the first week of the tennis tour. But what we also just wanted to touch on was the coverage of that tennis tour, because Matt has, as you've been hearing, been up all night watching tennis matches. They've been available, which is great. All you want to be able to do is watch the tennis matches. One note I saw this morning from the German journalist Yannick Schneider was that despite Germany winning the United Cup, it was an event that wouldn't have been seen by that many people in Germany because it was only on tennis TV. I don't know what the exact rights situation is in Germany, but that's disappointing. And we here in the UK, we have been inundated with emails from tennis fans over the last couple of weeks concerned about the sort of coverage of the sport on TV because this follows a rights change over here with Sky Sports taking over the ATP and WTA tours along with the US Open, which was from last year, from Amazon Prime Video. Now, a bit of background, Sky held those rights for some 20 plus years until 2018. I mean, that's how I grew up and really got interested in the sport, was watching Sky's coverage. I used to love watching Jerry Williams and Bill Threlfall and all the 90s commentators and the coverage they had. It was absolutely fantastic. And that went to Amazon Prime Video in 2018. They held those rights for 5 years, and Sky have now come back to take them over. Now, you probably know that Catherine, of course, hosted the Amazon coverage, and I do want to be open and disclose that and reference it as part of the conversation, but it is frankly irrelevant, I think, to that conversation. It's not why we're talking about it. We know many people who work for the Sky team. I've worked many Grand Slams with Gigi Salmon and Jonathan Overend, who are heading up their team. They're brilliant. They're really great, excellent broadcasters, and I have no doubt they're going to do a really good job with it. The reason we're getting so many emails and there's so much chat about the coverage and its future at the moment is, A, because at the moment, Sky haven't replicated the Amazon service in terms of the ability to choose which match viewers want to watch. Matt touched on that a week ago. It's kind of like being going back in time. Here's your running order. Watch it, and no choice involved. And the second thing is the price. I have had a look into the price and what you can get Sky Sports for here in the UK if you don't already have it. You can get it without any other channels, just the sports stuff, on Now TV for £34.99. So that's about £420 a year. If you already have Sky without sports, it will cost you about another £20 or so to add them. So that's going to be about £500 and something in total. Now, by way of comparison, the current Amazon Prime membership is costing me £95 a year or £8.99 a month. So you're talking about a quarter of the price of what tennis fans are going to be asked to pay now as a result of this change. There is the option of Tennis TV, as I mentioned, in Germany. That's going up, though, from £9.99 to £11.99, and they only show ATP matches. You won't get the WTA tour on that at all, or the US Open. And Matt said, you said last week, that really the WTA tour is the loser in that, because there are just so many matches over the last week that have not been available to watch here in the UK. So I asked somebody I know at Sky whether they are going to have match-by-match service, and was told that at the moment they can't say anything about it, and when they can, they will let us know. I did see on Twitter that somebody wrote to one of the Sky Sports tennis producers and just pleaded for them to bring all court coverage and give them the choice. And the answer to that tweet was, we will. So fingers crossed. I wanted to at least look into that for the many people asking us about what's happening. And I have to say personally, I mean, I am a fan of Sky Sports coverage generally of the sports that they do. I watch football there. I watch NFL. I watch the golf. It's not cheap, but it's a really good service if you're into all those things. I think the problem comes when you're not into all those other sports. And obviously the sheer cost of it, I mean, it is a heck of a lot of money for a lot of people. And if you only want the tennis, then you've really got to dig deep in order to see it. The plus side from a tennis perspective, whilst they're going to lose, I think, a lot of those particular dedicated tennis fans who simply can't afford it, they're probably going to gain a lot of people by the fact that they are an established platform and they're advertising it really heavily on their main platforms. I saw 5 million people were watching the darts final the other day, and tennis at the same time was advertised at the head of it. So that's really good news. But it is a concern, the sheer amount that's been paid for, that you have to pay for it. And the hope is that if in the future that match choice will be available. I personally think it will. I think that, that'll just take a little bit of time to come. But Matt, it's an important element to watching TV in 2024, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you've put it really well there in terms of it feeling a bit like going back in time, because it has felt like that this opening week of the season. You know, I mentioned last week the Amanda Anisimova comeback was not available to watch here. I tried to watch Aryna Sabalenka's match against Zhu Lin the other day, and that was not available. And I think there are some questions about what that match choice will end up looking like. You know, Sky is just, it's not an app on a smart TV like Prime is, or like Tennis TV is, which is so ready-made for a streaming option to have lots available. You know, I don't know whether it will be a red button situation or whether it will be a Sky Go situation. I mean, those would be much better than nothing. But even those don't quite feel like replicating the standard that had been set by Amazon and by Tennis TV for the ATP. I saw Steve Fraser make the point this week on Twitter that Steve Simon's decision all those years ago to take WTA off Tennis TV has really hurt the tennis fan, you know, and it's really hurt the WTA, I think, in terms of promotion. I mean, I said last week, it's so stark that when Tennis TV has the United Cup, the promotion that they're then able to give the women's matches and the highlights package they're able to create is just something we don't get the rest of the year. And I think it's such a shame. I agree. I'm sure they will get there, Sky, with the match choice. But I've been disappointed that it wasn't ready to go from the start. You know, you've got the rights already, and there are multiple matches to watch. And it just feels pretty unsatisfactory that through the first few months of this season, we're not getting that option. One thing I would say is I get, and this is, I'm sorry to anyone who isn't in the UK for this, but I get Sky Sports through a Virgin stream box, and that works out at about £18.50 a month, which I think is the cheapest way that I've found to get Sky Sports. But you have to have Virgin internet for that. But if you wanted to sort of get a bit of a package with internet and Sky Sports, that is one way of doing it. That's what I've done. But yeah, as you said, there are lots of benefits. They are promoting the tennis. I was watching Monday Night Football and it was promoted on there. They're doing, you know, social media as well. So, you know, it can be a good thing for getting eyeballs on tennis, but it feels pretty sort of obstructive so far as a way in for the sort of dedicated tennis fan. It's not been a great start to the season to be able to watch WTA tennis in the UK. It's just been so hard, and you've been limited by what you're able to watch, which is a shame.
Well, fingers crossed that all improves in time. I mean, knowing some of the people involved, I'm sure they are listening and going to do what they can to improve it. That can't come soon enough. Now, a couple of other bits of news just before we finish up. Madison Keys, sadly, is out of the Australian Open with a shoulder injury. Liam Brody, from a British perspective as well, is out with an ankle injury. He was making the point today on social media that he doesn't want to take the check, and it's massive. I mean, it's £64,000 that he's sacrificing, but he doesn't want to be out for 3 months by playing on it, and he also doesn't think it's fair, which I think is a really good message, you know, to give to other players, to think about, you know, the importance of the sport and the other players' opportunities that you're taking away if you just pitch up. But it's a heck of a loss, a heck of a hit in the pocket for him, having finally got into the Australian Open. There's no wild card for Rodionova, despite being the top-ranked Australian woman. Goodness me, that's a bit of a controversy. I think she was quite outspoken about that as well, as I seem to remember on the old social media. I'm not surprised, to be honest. We've got loads more tennis this week. I tell you what, Matt, you're going to have your apps ready again, and if you can find them. WTA Adelaide 500 has got Rybakina, Pegula, Krejcikova. Paola Badosa is going to make her return. We've got Hobart happening. We've got Auckland ATP event happening this time with Ben Shelton as the top seed. Denis Shapovalov making his return. I wonder what he sees, thinks when he sees Jamie Delgado coaching Grigor Dimitrov to such success. Maybe that's a decision he shouldn't have made. Anyway, there's the tournament in Adelaide with Tommy Paul and... Oh, big surprise, Nicholas Jarry's in the agenda. Top two seeds in the Adelaide 250. And we've got Australian Open qualifying starting as well. So, yeah, that's the week to come. We will be out in Melbourne joining up with Catherine on Wednesday night following our flights. The draw for the Australian Open is on Thursday. So the three of us will be getting together to record a post-draw show. We've then got all the press conferences from the players on Friday. And if all goes according to plan, our general idea is to have a live show on YouTube on Saturday morning from Melbourne, which will be nighttime or evening time on Friday in the UK. It'll be afternoon or earlier in the day in the United States, depending on where you are. But yes, we will let you know. Keep across our newsletter and we'll let you know when our live show is going to be. We'll also be making that into a podcast, of course, as well, reacting to Media Day and all the press conferences. And then the tournament, don't forget, it's a bit like bringing your clocks forward and back. It starts on Sunday. So don't get caught out and think the tournament starts on Monday like it used to, because you'll have missed the whole day. So don't plan anything for Sunday, all right? You've just got to watch tennis and listen to us. Catherine, final bit of business. We have a mascot for this episode, and I don't really know how to pronounce the name of the dog owned by Ted Vasquez, but I'm going to give it a go. Chicklet or Chicle?
I think it's Chicklet.
Okay. Ted says Chicklet is a 6-year-old. What is this? A Shih Poo.
Shih Tzu poodle cross.
Okay, great. And Ted adopted her when he accompanied a friend who was adopting a dog at a local shelter and decided to go along for the ride. My friend left with no dog. I left with Chicklet. She loves chasing lizards and iguanas and romping on the beach. Can you tell we live in Florida? That's Ted talking about Chicklet, who is wearing a little pullover, a little pink woolly jumper.
It's a lovely little jumper. Billie Jean would look good in that. Very fetching.
Yeah. It's giving it's a fetching folklore dog.
It's
evermore.
A, it's a... Oh, it is. It's a great, great dog, well, thank and it's a great you. Look.
Thank you, Ted, for bringing Chicklet into our lives.
She's really gorgeous. Really gorgeous. Yeah.
And if you haven't heard your pet talked about and drooled over on the tennis podcast, it's just because we haven't got to him or her just yet. And we will be sending out a note asking for details of pet mascots and shout-outs for the 2024 editions, which have been snapped up with great fervour over the last month or so. Yeah, we'll be sending out a note asking for those, but we're still trying to get through the 2023 backlog. Enjoying every minute of it at the moment. You'll be able to see a picture of Chicklet in the newsletter, which will be going out in a few days' time. So make sure you're signed up to that. And as a final point of business, we have our own presenter mascots. I've got Francis the Cat. Catherine's got Darwin. Matt has got Hyder and Soma. And we have our top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. Thank you all, as always. And Matt, we have shout-outs.
Yes, we have 5 shout-outs, starting with Laura Slattery, who is in Dublin.
Hello, hey. Laura. We've had Laura before, haven't we? We know Laura.
Yes, Laura says, I'm an Andy Murray and Ons Jabeur fan who's been a listener since 2016.
Good stuff, Laura. These are good
like Laura
things.
Laura Sigmund.
Like Laura Sigmund, United Cup champion.
Yeah.
Although
thanks,
we're
Laura.
Supposed to call her Laura, aren't we? And maybe maybe Laura Slattery is also a Laura, but maybe not. Like Laura Robson.
Indeed.
There we go. Thank you, Laura.
We've also got Keturah. We know Keturah.
Oh, hey. Keturah. She is a quiz fiend, Keturah.
Yeah, she beats me every year.
Every time.
She was also the owner of our first ever mascot, Charlie the Ferret.
Yeah. Debut mascot.
All those years ago.
Charlie will always have that. Thank you, Keturah. Thanks for your ongoing support, always. It's much appreciated.
We've got Courtney McCreesh, who is in Vienna, Virginia, USA.
Okay.
Ooh, I didn't know there was a Vienna in Virginia.
Me neither. Courtney says, my brother got me into the tennis podcast during the pandemic. We love it.
Aww.
Thanks, Courtney.
We love it when good things come out of the pandemic. Like Courtney Walsh, the Australian tennis writer.
Yeah, who we'll be seeing in a few days' time. Lovely bloke.
Yeah, who's a mean tennis player, isn't he, Matt?
Yes, he'll be beating me in a few days' time.
Thank you, Courtney.
And we've also got Karthik Jayaraman, who is in Melbourne.
Hello, Karthik. Oh,
all right,
perfect.
Karthik. We'll see you there.
Yeah, we might actually. Do we know anything else about Karthik?
A long-time listener and fan of the pod, obsessed with tennis and has been going to the Australian Open for the last 15 years since moving from the US.
Oh, wow. That's more years than me.
That's good.
Go on, Karthik.
So maybe just missed out on the 2008 show that we relived?
That yes.
But there or thereabouts.
But we'll have access to the opportunity to relive it, courtesy of being a friend of the tennis podcast. So,
exactly.
Well done, Karthik.
Thanks, Karthik.
And finally, we have Wilson Lee, who is in San Jose. And Wilson would like to give a shout out to Chris Evert, because Wilson says, for 9 years, I had the privilege to drive for the longest running women's tournament in the world. 1 year, Chris Evert stepped into my car and instead of sitting in the usual rear seat, insisted on riding in the front. Normally, passengers are too preoccupied to chat, but in this case, Chris asked for my first name before I could even greet her. She asked about me and my life for the whole journey. As we reached the destination, she told me how delighted she was to talk, remembering my name, said goodbye, Wilson. Her geniality made her more than just an all-time great. I want to take an opportunity to give her a shout-out. Which I thought was lovely.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Wow. Thank you, Wilson.
Thank you, Wilson. Those are really lovely words. They tally with the person that I've come across a few times, Chris Evert, and I think all of us would like to just wish her the very best at what is a really difficult time with her having to undergo treatment once again for cancer. We hope that that Chrissy is going to be really well really soon and back on the tennis scene. But Wilson, thanks so much for being a friend of the tennis podcast. Thank you for those kind words. Thank you to all friends of the tennis podcast, because you're enabling us to really do what we're doing and to throw ourselves into this job of producing the tennis podcast. Doesn't always feel like a job, but we do work hard, honest. And we're going to be out in Melbourne producing nightly editions of the show. We can't wait. Catherine, Matt, I'm just going to burst with excitement. So we better get off air. And yeah, we'll speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.